Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we have the privilege, once again, of sitting in on a symposium held in memory of the late pioneering intelligent design thinker Philip E. Johnson, held last November in Berkeley. Two Discovery Institute senior fellows and long-term friends of Philip Johnson, though they would certainly call him more than a friend, share their thoughts in this episode. We start with biologist Jonathan Wells, and we continue after that with philosopher of biology, Paul Nelson.
I met Phil in 1991. I was a graduate student in developmental biology here at the University of California, and I heard that a law professor, had published a book about evolution. Well, at that point, I had read so many second and third rate books about evolution that I wasn't interested. But a friend who was a biochemist convinced me that I really should read Phil's book. So I did, and I couldn't put it down. When I was done, I wanted to stand up and cheer. So I called Phil the next day. This is the book, by the way, Darwin on Trial. I called Phil the next day, and we ended up having lunch at the faculty club. We became good friends. In his book, Phil re-emphasized a distinction that had been made by evolutionary biologists back in the 1930s between microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution refers to minor changes within existing species. We all know it happens. We can see it just in this room where we're sitting. There's no real controversy about whether microevolution occurs. Macroevolution refers to the origin of new species, organs, and body plans. Now, we can tell it's happened, in a sense, because we see a large diversity of species and organs and body plans. But how did it happen? According to modern evolutionary theory, there are two aspects of how it happened. One is that all living things are descended from one or a few common ancestors. So we share common ancestors with a worm. Say. The second aspect of the theory is that the diversification that has happened because of accidental mutations and natural selection or survival of the fittest. Well, when I was at Berkeley in 1991, I was already a skeptic of the second part of the theory. That is, I knew that mutations and natural selection could not get us where we are today. But at the time, I just accepted the idea that we're all descended from common ancestors. I didn't question that. Well, that's sometimes called the fact of evolution. And biologists, even some biologists at the time, questioned the second aspect of the theory, the mechanism. But questioning the fact of evolution was beyond the pale. Well, I was studying embryology at the time, and from seeing the embryos myself, I could tell that the evidence for this universal common ancestry was extremely thin. In particular, I remember from my textbooks drawings of early embryos of animals with backbones showing that they all, in the beginning, looked like fish. So this supposedly proved our common ancestry with mice, birds, turtles, salamanders, and fish. But I was looking at the embryos myself, and I could see that these drawings were not true. They were faked. Well, when I read Phil's book, with his laser-like logic, he convinced me that the other evidences for common ancestry were also weak or worse. So when we met, when Phil and I met, I also met through him Paul Nelson, whom you'll hear from in a minute, and Paul and I worked together to contribute in a minor way to Phil's second version of Darwin on Trial. Here it is, came out in 1993, and we helped him with the section on embryology. I should add that not everyone in what's become known as the modern intelligent design movement agrees with Phil and me and Paul that the evidence for common ancestry is weak or non-existent. But Phil's genius was to create what he called a big tent. And this tent included anyone who questioned the idea that unguided mutations and natural selection could produce the wonderful variety that we see. That is, anyone who questioned the denial of design. So the big tent included Paul and me. It included people who still found the evidence for common ancestry compelling. It included old Earth creationists, young Earth creationists, people who think that we evolved but that God guided the process. All these people were welcome into the big tent. Well, once I saw these embryo drawings and realized they were fake, I looked a little further and realized that the textbooks I had been using since high school to learn biology contained other images that were also misrepresenting the evidence or even faking it. And so in 2000, with Phil's encouragement, I put out a book called Icons of Evolution. It's about 10 textbook images that are in fact false in one way or another. In at least two cases, like the embryo drawings, they were faked. Since then, I've been following a lot of things, including the textbooks, and just 2 years ago published another book showing that what I call the icons were pretty much still there. So that book came out in 2017, is called Zombie Science, because the icons, although empirically dead, continue to stalk the halls of our schools and universities like the Walking Dead. So their widespread use convinces me, I mean, not that I needed convincing in 2017, that Phil was right 28 years ago. 28 years ago. Time flies when you're having fun. He was right that Darwinism is not about science at all. It's about applied materialistic philosophy. He was right then, and it's still true. Good work, Phil.
Phil and Kathy love to read. It was, after all, by reading Richard Dawkins and Michael Denton in 1987 that Phil launched onto the path which brought us Darwin on Trial. Kathy values reading so much, as many of you know, that she turned the lower level of the Johnson home on Watkins Street into one of the world's largest private collections of children's literature, a collection she makes available to the children of Berkeley. Now, readers such as Phil and Kathy love words. They love these lexical treasures, their echoes and surprises, the many colors and shades of meaning in a word, a phrase, a metaphor. Phil was a master of discerning the varied shades of meaning in a word, and from there, detecting the buried assumptions in academic writing of all flavors, especially from 1987 onward in scientific and philosophical literature. Now, woe betide you as an author if you tried to wrap up a shoddy or question-begging premise in high-sounding language. Phil would find you out. But Phil also honored clarity and honest arguments, even if in the end he disagreed with their conclusions. Moreover, Phil was never confused, Phil never confused the language we use to describe the world in our imperfect and fumbling ways with the world itself. "Words are the daughters of earth," said the great English poet and lexicographer Samuel Johnson in the 18th century. Note the last name, I think that's not accidental. "Words are the daughters of earth, and things are the sons of heaven." Phil had an attitude towards reality that had several important features. One was that we are not of our own devising. The beating of our heart we owe to no act of our own wills. That attitude of not taking the world for granted or trying to force it to conform to any philosophy lives on today in what has become an international community of intelligent design thinkers and theorists, some of whom are here on the dais with me. There's something else that lives on as a heritage from Phil, the expectation that when we see the natural world set free from our slavery to the philosophy of materialism, we cannot help but be surprised, even astonished. Let's face it, friends, philosophical materialism is boring. An open-ended natural world, however, is not boring. It's anti-boring. And I want to live in the anti-boring world, the fascinating one, and I hope that's true for you as well. Phil's face, and everyone on this dais will agree with me, would take on a characteristic expression when he was about to activate his Socratic mode.
You knew instantly when you saw that distinctive look. We can give it a name. Says who? So, Phil would inquire, evolution is a purposeless process which did not have us in mind, a process whose truth we cannot doubt. Says who? So, there's this stuff, junk DNA, says who? Now, this says who attitude prepares one to be watching for contrary data. My personal heritage from Phil was the awareness he encouraged of watching for evidential anomalies in biology. Anomalies which pointed in directions away from the received view. Phil distrusted what we might call the wisdom of the academic majority, because there were all kinds of bad reasons that one could have for wanting to be in the majority, reasons other than a search for truth. Since by definition the received view just is the majority opinion, Phil encouraged those he mentored, such as the speakers here, to watch out for aspects of reality the majority might be overlooking. In my case, that aspect was unexpected molecular evidence, the evidence revealed by whole genome DNA sequencing, a research technology which entered biology as a practical tool in the mid-1990s, about 5 years after Darwin on Trial was first published. Biology will never be the same. DNA sequencing technology will turn out to be as important to biology as the invention of the telescope was to astronomy. You see that steeply rising blue curve? That shows the deposition in the DNA database GenBank of DNA sequence information starting in 1995. Now, if evidence represents the dollars in the bank of the scientific corporation, we can say that before 1995, comparative genetics was about the size of a mom-and-pop grocery store, whereas today it is approaching the cash on hand of Apple or Amazon with no end in sight. Or if financial metaphors are not your cup of tea, how about that for a mixed metaphor? Phil would scold me. Let's say that the blue curve represents a sharply rising mountain range. We can't see the top of the mountains yet, but we know we're still not there, and we won't be for a long, long time. Evolutionary theory itself was formulated way out on the left, in the flatlands out there, before the mountains. Now, the problem is, if you formulate a theory in the flatlands and you haven't seen the mountains yet, in fact, if you don't even know they're there, what you say in the flatlands is bound to be wrong. What DNA sequencing has revealed is a universe of genetic diversity vastly greater in extent than anyone realized or even imagined. Part of that universe are the so-called orphan or taxonomically restricted genes. These are DNA sequences found only in one species or genus. Orphan genes will revolutionize biology. They're doing so already. This little leafhopper, for example, spends its life on plants, in the mist, the dew, the rain. And the leafhopper says, gee, it sure would be nice if I had a super hydrophobic coating to put on my carapace to protect myself from all that water. Guess what? The leafhopper goes on. I actually make that hydrophobic coating. Those microscopic buckyball shapes in the lower right-hand corner, the little spheres you see there, are called brocosomes. They're composed of specialized proteins called brocosomins. The genes that code for those specialized proteins are orphan genes. I've got them, says the leafhopper. But right now, it looks like nobody else does. So this paper that was published in 2018 by a multidisciplinary research team analyzed those genes, and they could not find any molecular kin anywhere else in the databases. They belong just to that group. Orphan genes are revolutionary because they were completely unexpected by evolutionary theory. Back out there, on the left, in the flatlands. Let me revert to the astronomy parallel. Naked eye observation of the night sky reveals about 6,000 stars. That's what you can see with your own vision. 6,000 stars. That's what the Babylonians, the Egyptians, that's what the Greek astronomers could see. That's what Copernicus himself could see. Imagine giving a Babylonian astronomer or Copernicus the 100-inch reflector at Mount Wilson, or the Hubble Space Telescope. Something very similar is starting to happen in biology right now, and as we climb that blue curve, we are making discoveries that evolutionary theory never anticipated back out there on the flatlands when the theory was formulated. I wish Phil were still here with us to witness what is going to unfold in the next decade. I was going to make a statement about my weepy Norwegian genes at the start. You know, years ago I complained to God, do I have to cry at every meaningful public event in which I'm involved? But I'm going to compose myself. I wish Phil were still here with us, but I'm looking forward to a long conversation with him where we share a bottle of good red wine, some heavenly cheese and angelic sourdough bread, and a lot of good laughs. Told you so, Paul, he'll say. I told you so. Thank you.
Excellent, Paul. And the orphan genes are unexpected on evolutionary theory. Why?
Because evolutionary theory presumes that every gene in your body had an ancestor going back to the last universal common ancestor. So the molecular kin should be out there somewhere in genetic space, yet they're not.
That was Jonathan Wells and Paul Nelson speaking at a November 2019 symposium in honor of the late Philip E. Johnson. We'll have more to share from this significant gathering in the weeks to come, so please keep an eye on ID the Future at IDTheFuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.